I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a conversation with a Marine just back from his fourth tour in Iraq who tells of occasional triumphs and regular frustrations. But first, in a remarkable story, the New York Times reports today that techniques once used by the U.S. military to interrogate detainees at Guantanamo Bay were patterned, perhaps unwittingly, on techniques used by the Communist Chinese during the Korean War, techniques which at that time the U.S. called torture and knew elicited false confessions from captured U.S. soldiers. Scott Shane wrote the story, prompted by an unnamed source who noticed that the charge of interrogation techniques released at a Senate hearing last month was exactly the same as a chart of Chinese torture techniques. So, Scott, we should say these techniques are no longer used by the U.S. military, although the CIA can still use them. But explain how these techniques came from China to the U.S. You write, there was a 1957 Air Force study of the Chinese techniques, and that study produced a chart?
That's right. These airmen mostly who were captured during the Korean War and held by the Chinese and questioned by the Chinese, in some cases, a small number of cases, gave extensive confessions to various war crimes, which were turned out to be false. And this caused a huge uproar in the United States. And there was suspicion that the communists had some kind of special techniques, which came to be called brainwashing. And there was a lot of research being done on exactly what the Chinese had done. So this 1957 article in a medical journal, the Bulletin of the New York Academy of Medicine, was written by a sociologist, actually, who had interviewed a lot of the American prisoners and wrote down what the Chinese had done. And he put together a chart of the techniques that the Chinese had used and their psychological effects. And it doesn't include any of what we think of as extreme torture, you know, pulling fingernails out. It's more sleep deprivation, exposure to cold, semi-starvation, extreme darkness or bright light, monotonous food, complete isolation, threats of death, this kind of thing.
Well, as you write, this research on Chinese techniques became a training program for the U.S. military to prepare troops in the event they might be tortured. We've known that this program became known as SEER, or Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, and that Pentagon lawyers approached that program to ask about those techniques and how they might be used at Guantanamo?
That's right. There was concern both in the military and CIA that they needed tougher interrogation tactics to get suspected terrorists to talk. And they turned to this program seemingly without thinking through the history of the program and where it had come from.
Sure, because if, on the face of it, in effect, they were taking an anti-torture technique and then turning around and using it. Wouldn't that be torture?
Well, certainly in the 50s, these methods were described as torture. And in this 1957 article, for example, it describes forcing people to stand for hours on end as a form of torture.
Hmm. Well, and the chart was titled Communist Coercive Methods for Eliciting Individual Compliance. We understand, though, that when SEER military trainers brought these charts with them to Guantanamo Bay to teach interrogation, the entire chart went, but without the title. Do you think the trainers knew the original title and knew the connection to Chinese torture?
Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get the military to reveal whether the SEER trainers themselves knew the origins of their chart. My surmise from talking to people involved in that program is that they probably did not. That at some point this chart was photocopied, somebody took off the Communist Coercive Methods that was the title, and it began to be passed around, and they picked it up and used it 50 years later.
People you've spoken with say that this is, quite something, and critics that you've spoken with have said this is a remarkable case of historical amnesia.
Yes, I think that's what's striking about this, is that these techniques, which were once condemned as torture, of course, at the height of the Cold War, and associated with false confessions, were then turned around and taught to American interrogators who were obviously not interested in false confessions. They were interested in accurate intelligence on the next terrorist attack.
Well, what does this information mean for upcoming trials of terror suspects? You write about the alleged 20th 9/11 hijacker, Mohammed al-Qahtani. Charges against him have been dropped. But another detainee on Monday was charged with taking part in the bombing of the USS Cole in 2000. So what do you think this news is going to do to impact upcoming trials?
Well, the question of torture and harsh interrogation has sort of haunted the attempt to prosecute all these guys. And, of course, here we are many years after 9/11, and the mastermind, so-called, of the 9/11 attack, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who himself was waterboarded, is still awaiting trial. Certainly their lawyers are going to raise and are raising the question of whether some of what they said was forced out of them by illegal torture, and it's complicating the attempt to prosecute them.
Scott Shane, reporter for the New York Times. Scott, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the new White House report card on Iraq gives satisfactory marks to Prime Minister Maliki's government on 15 of 18 benchmarks, according to the Associated Press today. The report credits the Iraqi government for passing an amnesty law for former members of Saddam Hussein's political party and for setting provincial elections for October, among other things, in a remarkably rosier assessment than last year's. But critics say that a satisfactory mark is not the same as reaching a benchmark, and the U.S. needs to shift more responsibilities to Iraqi leaders. Well, for some first-hand reflection on just how hard that is, we welcome Seth Moulton back to Here and Now. Seth is the 29-year-old Marine captain from Marblehead, Massachusetts, 2001 Harvard University grad who joined the Marines in 2002, was part of the fight for Baghdad in 2003, later an aide to General David Petraeus, fought in the battle for Najaf in 2004. Seth wrapped up his initial four-year commitment to the Marines in 2006, but returned to Iraq last year after Petraeus, who'd been promoted to U.S. commander there, personally asked him to come back. Seth spent the past year as part of a three-person team, including Sergeant Alex Lemons and Captain Ann Gildroy. They worked directly for General Petraeus, which upsets the regular chain of command. We want to hear about that. And he just returned from this fourth tour of duty in Iraq last week. So, Seth Moulton, welcome back.
Thanks very much, Robin.
So, you know, we just heard this report card from the White House. Give us yours. You know, how would you sum up the Iraq that you left?
It's decidedly mixed. I mean, there's been unquestionable military progress. There's certainly an improvement in security. But I think that what General Petraeus says about the difference between military progress and long-term sustainable political progress, about how there's not yet a light at the end of the tunnel and how the gains we've seen are fragile and reversible, I think that's all true.
Right. Well, give us an example of, you write about triumphs and frustrations. So, you know, give us, just a paint a scene for us of each.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that we worked on for a long time was getting tribal security forces down in Diwaniya, south of Baghdad, to cooperate with us in opposing the militia. And we were very successful. We found that a lot of the tribesmen out there were a lot more ideologically opposed to the militia and the violence they represent than even a lot of Americans had previously thought. And they very courageously stood up, and often just with a single rifle and a road guard vest standing at the side of the road preventing IEDs for a small salary that we paid them. And over the course of several months, together with them and the Iraqi army and the other coalition forces, we were really able to deal a significant blow to the militia in the area. And violence decreased dramatically. But what filled the void from the militia was the Iranian-backed Badr Party political regime. They have an iron hand on the police, and they're really known for some rather insidious oppression of the populace. At least that's what people say when you ask people on the street. And they've been very opposed to these very tribesmen who helped them gain that victory because they see them as political opposition.
And you write that Maliki, also in this case in Diwaniya, sort of backed this Iranian-backed Badr political party that came in and filled the void of the militias. And what? Your work unravels?
A lot of it did. I mean, literally guys that were standing on the side of the road preventing IEDs and standing up against the militia started getting arrested by the local police because, in effect, they were seen as political opposition by the governor.
So what do you do then? I mean, it feels as if, You know, what you're saying is that you can bring about military success because you had these people who were willing to put on these vests and look for IEDs and stand up to the militias, but you can't force politics.
No, we can't. And it's harder and harder to force politics as we hand over more and more control to the Iraqis. In some ways, I think that we've probably handed over too much control too soon because the political situation is not at all stable, and yet it's totally out of our control.
Well, we need to say, too, that you felt betrayed. You wrote in your online journal that we'll talk – your personal journal that we'll talk about. You wrote that you felt betrayed by this. But we heard a report this morning on NPR about another group, the Sons of Iraq. This is a Sunni tribal group in Anbar province that fought al-Qaeda there. In this case, their sense of betrayal was that it was the U.S. military that stepped in and replaced the leader of their group because the U.S. military said, look, members of the police and military don't trust you, so we kind of have to go this way. So it feels as if, you know, this sort of political sense of betrayal is happening a lot.
It's true. I mean, the tribal security initiatives have been incredibly successful at improving security in Iraq, there's no question, and especially in places like Anbar, but also in lesser-known places like Diwaniya. But the Iraqi government has not taken over these contracts. They have not integrated these men into the Iraqi security forces, into the police and the army. And so it's still an outstanding problem. I mean, down in Diwaniya, we had to go out and try to convince and try to explain to these guys, you know, who looked us in the eye and said, we trusted you to stand up against the militia. We trusted you because you said you would fight alongside us. And now the police is coming out to arrest us, and you seem powerless to stop them. And that's tough.
Well, so it's sort of like I asked you to, you know, a couple of to give us examples of some of the joyous achievements and also some of the failures. But it sounds as if the joyous achievement keeps tumbling into failure.
Well, not in every case. I mean, there's no question that people in D1E, I mean, when we left, we received a tremendous, a surprising amount of thanks from a lot of local citizens who really gave us a lot of credit for bringing about the improvement in security. And the fact that they can go to the market every day without being in fear of blowing up or getting blown up is hugely significant. I mean, that's a real change in life. But at the same time, if they don't see any political future, if they don't feel like they have any stake in the government, if they feel like the biggest player in Iraq in many ways is Iran, then it's hard to look at the long-term situation and be optimistic.
Well, but it gets complicated because doesn't the U.S. support some of the Iranian-backed groups as well? And so there's, you know, it's very netty.
It is. It's incredibly complicated.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. And sometimes I think for the average soldier or Marine on the ground, it's very frustrating when it seems like you've done everything right and yet some very high-level Iraqi or even American politics get in and change things around.
We're talking to Seth Moulton, 29 years old, just returned from his fourth tour of Iraq, a Marine captain from Marblehead, Massachusetts. When we come back, Seth, I want to ask you about a story that you've told us about some puppies. This broke my heart, made me angry, but it also may be illustrative of what you're talking about and some of the problems in Iraq. So we'll do that when we come back. Also later today, Dr. Timothy Johnson on heart disease and the tests that maybe you want to take and the tests maybe that are a waste of time and what did happen to Tim Russert and what we can learn from that. That's later today as well. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more from Marine Captain Seth Moulton, who just returned last week from his fourth tour in Iraq. He's sharing his experience with us. And one of them, you know, made us angry as, you know, we're dog lovers here. But I'm wondering what else it might say for you about what's going on in Iraq. So let's tell this story about how you and your teammates adopted three puppies, adopting dogs on base, a military tradition. Loved the puppies. One night they got off base. And as you write, some medical soldiers and an American contractor captured them, chopped off their heads and sent them to Baghdad to get tested for rabies because there was a rule about concern about rabies in dogs. Now, you know, as you say at the time, a lot of worse things happen, and you've seen firsthand a lot of worse things that have happened. But for a country where there are many people and things to hate, the puppies were something we could all love. What did that story do to you?
Well, I mean, honestly, it feels, you know, in some ways a little trite and silly to talk about it. But I think that it, in some ways, is illustrative of the way this war is going. And, I mean, one thing that General Petraeus has taught us is the importance of realizing that this is an insurgency we're fighting, and we need to be waging a counterinsurgency campaign. And counterinsurgency, successful counterinsurgencies, are characterized by giving a lot of freedom and responsibility to low-level commanders to do creative things outside the box. And I think one thing that I've seen change over the course of four deployments in Iraq is the American bureaucracy gets worse and worse every time. And so you go to these bases where we, you know, used to live very much amongst the people and suffer from the same kinds of things they did when we didn't have power or we lost water or, you know, we experienced a lot of the same challenges that the Iraqis did. And instead now we live in very, very well insulated bases where people have time to worry about things like dogs running around.
Well, regulations and rules.
And sure, there's some medical personnel which would tell you some story of somebody being, hit with rabies or something like that. I've never seen that. The point was the time and effort that people put into, you know, seeking out and trying to kill a few puppies that were, you know, I mean, we were with a special forces team, and there was about 20 guys with us who really liked these dogs. And the fact that people would see it as a priority when there's so many things wrong and we don't have enough troops to fight the war.
But as you write, these were people who weren't fighting the war. They layer of bureaucracy looking for something to do.
I don't think they've ever been outside the wire. I don't think that they have really contributed anything in many ways tangible to the fight. But that's the job they're given. I mean, here, these are probably good soldiers who, you know, are trying to do their job. I can't speak for the contractors in the same light. But I think in some ways it's a little bit of a stretch, but it is in some ways illustrative of the way that the U.S. military has kind of fallen away from the primary task of war fighting as these bases become more developed, as our deployments become longer and people become more entrenched with the idea of just living in Iraq.
Yeah, and we do take your point that, you know, you put it in context that there were people standing right next to you that were lost, and you are well aware that of how big that loss was. And that, I don't want to ask you, Seth, you didn't have to go back to Iraq. You told us the last time you were here you went because Petraeus asked you to go. And I know you don't like to talk about policy at all. You're a boots-on-the-ground guy. And I've asked you this question before, and you've hesitated to answer it. But given that, yes, there are improvements in Iraq, but given that Osama bin Laden is still operating, that Afghanistan is unraveling, that we know now more than ever that there was no connection between al-Qaeda and Iraq, do you find yourself coming home on reentry and asking, was this worth it? Why did we do this?
I think the problem is, and the challenge is, that I do find myself coming home and asking that question in many respects. Hmm. And I think very many soldiers and Marines in Iraq, quite honestly, do ask, you know, why did we ever come here in the first place? But at the same time, I think that Iraq is a tremendous problem, both for the Middle East and the United States, and indeed for the war and for the world. And so I don't think my feelings have changed about the necessity to somehow try to fix that problem. And I think that's why I went back, and I think that's why people like General Petraeus and others keep fighting this fight, as challenging and difficult as it is. And I think it's why, you know, as we look forward to a new presidency, we still have to find a solution here. And I'm not sure that just leaving is the right answer.
In the couple minutes we have, here you are back. And I'm trying to think. You're 29 now. I'm trying to do the math. I can't. 2003, so that you were, what, 23, 22? That's a big chunk. That's your whole 20s to Iraq, given to Iraq. What's it like to come back? I mean, are you feeling like you have to catch up with people your age?
In some ways, I do. I mean, I feel like these are the best years of my life. And I don't know that I would change what I've done with them. I mean, I'm very proud of serving with some of the most amazing people I've ever met in my life in the Marines in Iraq. Mm. At the same time, though, I do feel like I've missed some things. I feel like I've missed a lot. Mm. And, you know, if you'd told me when I joined the Marines, when I decided to join the Marines out of college in 2001 before September 11th, if you had told me that 5 years of my 20s would be consumed by a war, I wouldn't have believed you. It's a little strange.
Will you go back if asked again?
I don't know. I mean, I just got home right now, Rob, and I think that it would be. I'll say this: I think that I'm very much looking forward to moving on with my life and doing other things outside the Marine Corps in Iraq. But so long as there are troops over there, I think it'd be very hard for me to say no.
And we want to ask you one last thing. One time when you visited with us, it was with your friend Mohammed, who was the Iraqi, the wacky Iraqi you met in Iraq, and the two of you had a television show together. And how is he?
He is fantastic. He, this past year, became the first Arabic teacher in Phillips Academy Andover's history.
Here in Massachusetts?
Here in Massachusetts.
Where you went to high school?
Where I went to high school. It's a fantastic school. And they finally started teaching Arabic. And they hired Mohammed to do it. Apparently there are waiting lists for his classes. He's quite popular.
Well, and I know that you and other troops we've talked to, but I know you're very concerned about the Iraqi friends you left behind and trying to get them back. So we wish you the best, get them out in many cases. So we wish you the best with that and whatever you choose to do.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Seth Moulton, a Marine captain, just returned from his fourth tour of duty in Iraq. The recent death of NBC's Tim Russert at the age of 58 was, of course, very sad, but it also made a lot of his contemporaries wonder about their own health and their waistlines. Like millions of people, Russert had apparently been earnestly following his doctor's advice to avoid a heart attack. He took blood pressure and cholesterol pills, aspirin. He had yearly stress tests and was trying to lose weight. But now, some are wondering, would a specific modern procedure that Russert apparently didn't have predicted the problem that ultimately killed him, maybe led the way to surgery? And why is it that women should have waistlines less than 35 inches, men less than 40? Dr. Tim Johnson is medical editor for ABC News. He's also a Here and Now contributor. And Dr. Tim, remind us first, what was the plaque problem that killed Tim Russert? Because we understand there are different kinds of plaque.
There are, Robin, and it's really important to understand the difference. The plaques that we talk about and have known about for 50, 100 years are the ones that grow slowly in the center of the artery, slowly blocking the flow of blood, leading to symptoms like angina, chest pain, especially during exertion. These are the blockages that we can detect with stress tests or angiograms when you put dye in the arteries, because they sit in the center of the artery where the blood flows.
Mm-hmm.
These plaques, however, usually do not kill you. They produce symptoms. You can correct the symptoms with an angioplasty or bypass surgery, but they're usually not lethal. The other kind of plaques that we've learned about in the last 10 to 15 years are plaques that are hidden in the wall of the artery. We say they're hidden because they don't bulge into the center, causing decrease in blood flow, but they sit there in the wall, usually surrounded by inflammation, and they can suddenly burst open like a boil and spew their contents into the center of the artery where the blood flows, causing a major blood clot and a sudden heart attack. These are the kinds of plaques that can kill you. And you can have normal stress tests and still have these plaques in the wall of the artery that can suddenly kill you, which is what happened in his case.
Yeah, very, very tragically. Well, and he knew that he had heart problems. His doctors were carefully monitoring him. 10 years ago, Tim Russert had a CT scan of his coronary arteries and indicated that he had artery disease. Now, tell us about the CT scans, because we're hearing a lot about the newer scans now. So differentiate for us.
The scan that he would have had 10 years ago would indeed be able to pick up calcium deposits in the walls of the artery, an indirect indication of possible coronary artery disease. The newer scans are much more precise in the detail they show. They are usually called 64 slice scans, CT scans, because they have 64 pictures they take in one revolution of the tube, and they show you such detail that, in fact, you can now see some detail in the wall of the artery showing these kinds of hidden plaques I was talking about. The question is, who should have these? We can't do them every year on everybody. We would bankrupt the healthcare system. So there's a lot of debate about when and if these scans should be used. One place they are used with value is in the emergency room. When somebody comes in with sudden chest pain, these scans can be done quickly in the emergency room and provide a lot of information. But whether we should use them for screening is quite another matter. Once you put a person on statin drugs, there's less reason to use these scans, because if you found some on scans, that's what you would do. You would put them on the statin drugs. So a lot of doctors are using them in their office, probably, to be blunt, more for money-making reasons than for solid medical reasons.
Now, I want to back you up just a second. The statin drugs, which you would put someone on if you used a CT scan and found that they had issues, lower cholesterol.
Well, yes, the statin drugs do many things. They lower bad cholesterol quite dramatically. They sometimes raise good cholesterol modestly. They fight inflammation, which we think may be even more important than lowering cholesterol, because it fights the inflammation in those plaques that are hidden in the wall, trying to prevent them from bursting open. And you don't have to have a CT scan to make the diagnosis that you might need statins. If you simply have elevated bad cholesterol, most doctors will put you on the statins without even having to do a scan.
Well, tell us more about the debate over, you know, Tim Russert has come to stand for this debate over,
yes,
over care. I mean, you know, because some were saying, well, he should have had the CT scan or he should have had an angiogram, you know, with a catheter threaded into his
right
arteries and dye injected to see what was there and possibly had, you know, bypass surgery. How do you know when you know you have high cholesterol and some heart disease, how do you know how much further to go?
Well, that is always an issue. Now, he did have a stress test, therefore there's not much reason to do an angiogram. You usually do an angiogram when you get a bad stress test to find out exactly where the blockages are. And again, I remind you, these kinds of blockages are usually not the ones that kill you. They produce symptoms and you correct them. So from what I can tell, his doctor was doing what the vast majority of cardiologists would do. He'd done blood tests showing high cholesterol. He put him on statin drugs. I suppose you could argue about which statin drug and whether or not he was getting a high enough dose. He was on medicine for high blood pressure. He was trying to reduce weight. So he was doing all the right things. The CAT scan of the arteries wouldn't have really added anything to the decision-making process.
Yeah.
It would have simply confirmed what they already knew by the blood test. I'm not criticizing his care at all. Care is never perfect. People still do, unfortunately, drop dead from coronary artery disease, even though they're getting proper treatment.
Right, and we're not evaluating his care as much as seeing what we can learn from it, you
know?
And that brings the question, are there any other biomarkers? Is there anything else that someone can do, a blood test or something, to learn more about their heart?
Yes, in addition to the lipid profile, as we call it, which tells us about the total cholesterol, how much is good, how much is bad, very important to know those numbers. They're the critical numbers. You can also do an indirect test for possible inflammation in the coronary arteries. It's a test called the CRP test, C-reactive protein. If you are in a situation where the blood tests for fats are normal, but you're still worried about coronary artery disease, a lot of doctors will order this test now. And if that's elevated, they will go ahead and put you on statin drugs to fight inflammation, even though your fats or lipids, your LDL and HDL, may be okay.
Hmm. And one last question. Why is the waistline figure so important and so hard? It's considered dangerous to have above 40 inches for men,
yep,
and above 35 inches for women.
We now know that the fat around the waist is not just ordinary fat. It's active fat. It's metabolically active. It produces chemicals and substances that can be dangerous to the heart. So we take the weight around the waist even more seriously than weight in the hips or weight in other parts of the body.
You know, I want you to say that again, because I think that's new to a lot of people. There's different kinds of fat.
Yes, there are many different kinds of fat, and we've learned that the fat that's under the skin in the waist and in the abdominal area is more dangerous to the heart than fat in other parts of the body. It's more metabolically active, meaning it does things to chemicals in the body that can harm the heart. And so we do focus more on that fat than we did 10 years ago.
So 40 inches for the waist for men, try to keep it below that, and 35 inches for the women, try to keep it below that.
That's the way to go.
Yeah. Well, just fascinating. Dr. Tim Johnson, medical editor for ABC News, contributor to Here and Now. And I know your path probably crossed with Tim Russert's as well, and it seems as if in his passing he's teaching people a lot.
It is amazing how many questions are being asked because of his death, and in that sense, his tragic death, I think, will be ironically helpful to a lot of people.
Dr. Tim, thanks as always.
Okay.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, after an explosion at a Chinese factory, will there be enough fireworks for the 4th? That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, we get lots of emails with story ideas, but one recently caught our eye. It was from Megan Sullivan. It involved the other woman in her husband's life.
Supple and blonde, with limber legs and brown eyes, capable of disarming even me, the jealous wife, Kiva is the quintessential other woman. She taught me how to be the man I am today, my husband tells me, before confiding that not only did he always feel confident when Kiva stood beside him, but also that he was flattered by the attention the two of them received.
Kiva, the other woman, was Megan's husband's seeing-eye dog. What is it like for a sighted person to step into the love affair between a blind person and his dog? Well, Megan Sullivan teaches at Boston University and joins us in the studio to tell us. And in fact, Megan, you've told me that the answer is it can be a little awkward at first, or at least it was in your case.
Yes, it can be a little awkward because there is a partnership there already. And
yeah.
You're, in some ways, the third wheel.
And you didn't know much about blind people or dogs when you first met Carl, your husband. Tell us about that encounter.
When we first met, I actually didn't know he was blind, and it was a little awkward because right away I gave away my disinclination for dogs, calling a dog a, quote, yappy mutt.
You're sitting with a friend in a restaurant, right. A mutual friend. You just met Carl, and, you know, he's very attractive, and somehow you start talking about yappy mutts.
Exactly.
What did he say?
Well, there was an awkward pause, and then he said, oh, maybe this is a good opportunity to introduce you to Kiva, my guide dog, who's sitting underneath the table quietly. You know, I quickly tried to backpedal. Oh, no, dogs are fine. I like them. I don't run across the street to greet them.
Well, then the three of you begin dating, because that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us about the first date.
We met for a quick drink, but that quick drink turned into entree, dinner, dessert, coffee.
And then there was the first kiss.
Mm-hmm.
And Kiva, what?
She jumped right in the middle. She thought it was some big love fest that she could take part in. And I guess that should have been my hint that she would always be with us.
Well, and now you begin to see that as you and Carl obviously married. And you watch these two together. Just describe what it's like when they're together.
I think when you live with someone who's visually impaired, you don't really know what they go through every day. And I think I got more of a clue into that world when I saw Carl with Kiva, because there was such a bond of trust between them, because they rely on each other. They have to rely on each other.
Right. They move through the streets as a unit. Carl signals go right. Kiva does. Kiva pauses at a curb, sensing a car. Carl stops.
Yes.
And by now, you're falling in love with Kiva, too.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And I never expected that to happen. It's funny, Carl says he knew that Kiva liked me from the beginning when she hadn't necessarily liked other women.
Was there a time ever when you were jealous of her?
I'm always a little jealous. I mean, Carl said that she gave him his independence because, you know, he goes everywhere with Kiva. He goes on the T, he goes on airplanes, and, well, now she's retired, but she's a part of him all the time.
Well, the retirement. She had to retire because she had knee surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a moment you describe where Carl had to leave with the terrific new black lab seeing eye dog named Kinley.
Yes.
And he's going out the door, and Kiva bounds up to
go with him for months after Kiva retired. Carl would pick up the harness and Kiva would jump up because she would want to work again. And he would have to say, oh, no, sweetie, you can't come with me. Kinley's coming with me. And I had to turn away.
You had to turn away because it was
too
hard
much.
To watch.
It was hard.
Right. But now she's, you know, going on fun walks. And
oh, yeah. She loves it now.
What would you want people to know who might be entering into an existing relationship between a blind person and their seeing eye dog?
I think I would want them to know that they should watch that relationship carefully, because the way that the blind person and the dog interact, it's a relationship, unlike any other, but like so many others.
So you get to see them in a relationship.
Oh, absolutely. And that's what's so amazing about it. It just tells you what they're going to be like in a relationship. And then I think you have to accept it and not try to fight it.
More than accept it. You know, fall in love with it.
Yeah.
It's a threesome.
Yeah.
Ménage à trois.
In the best possible sense.
Megan Sullivan teaches rhetoric at Boston University. We'll post her essay, The Other Woman, at our website, here-now.org. Megan, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Okay, coming up, hold the lettuce. That's the only ingredient you won't grill in our recipe for grilled Greek salad. That's in 1 minute, here and now. We just responded to one of your emails, now another. We received a note from Jessica McKenzie saying, more food segments. All right, Jessica, today, a grilling lesson with Here Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. We met Kathy out on the roof of our mothership, WBUR, here in Boston.
So, Kathy, grilling, how appropriate. What shall we start with?
Well, I actually was sitting in a restaurant the other day having a Greek salad, thinking how it was so boring, but that I loved all the individual elements of it. So one of the things about grilling is that when you put things on at the same time, you know, like people make shish kebabs and they do the meat and the veggies and on, nothing cooks at the right time. So I thought, what if you deconstructed the whole salad?
A Greek salad?
A Greek salad. We are going to grill chicken, we're going to grill peppers, onions, we're going to grill olives, we're even going to grill feta cheese. So all the great elements of the salad, but on individual kebab skewers so that each one can cook perfectly and you're not competing like, oh, wait, I think the chicken's done, but the vegetable's not. And also for people like you that don't eat meat, you have a whole meal of vegetables, but you also have the meat and it's separate, so you can please many different types of people in one barbecue.
Well, I just can't wait to see the feta cheese grilling part.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
Get us started. What do we do?
Okay,
here?
The very first thing is It's like a garden. You have to prepare the soil. You have to prepare your grill. Okay, so the first step is to clean it. So you want to take a good brush. These are very inexpensive. And you want to scrub off the grill piece so that you don't have any pieces from your last barbecue there, because that's going to cause food to stick and then get in trouble. Mm-hmm. Now, the next thing is, the most important thing is it hot enough? Here's how you tell. Ready? Put your hand over the grill. If I can keep my hands, here you go, 6 inches above, you're at low. But that's hot, right? Go lower. 1 inch too hot, it's perfect.
So if at 1 inch that's too hot, that's good.
Yeah. Okay. Like you feel like, whoa, I need to move my hand.
Okay.
I have a skewer here with red onions. See, this is what I was talking about. Some things take longer than others, so we'll start with the red onions. And then I also have chicken that I've marinated in olive oil, lemon juice, oregano, and a little mint. But these are all the flavors, very Mediterranean, very Greek. And again, I'm keeping these separate. In fact, I'm going to move it over so that your veggies don't touch my chicken. Some people are picky about this. You're welcome. But this is called direct grilling, where you have a hot, high heat. You put the food directly on it. There's also something called indirect grilling, where you get hot charcoals. You move them to one side. Half of your grill is cool. Half of your grill is hot. And with things like ribs and certain types of whole chicken, you can even grill a whole turkey, you want to put it on the indirect side. So what we've got here is a skewer with red onions on it. We've got our chicken that I told you I marinated. Then I have beautiful orange and red and yellow peppers. We'll put those on. And then I also took green pimento-filled olives.
This is so funny.
Turns out that they get a very smoky, delicious flavor. And a hot grilled olive you're going to see is something fabulous.
Okay.
And then I have cherry tomatoes. I know there's this tomato scare, but any tomato that's on the vine, the cherry tomatoes, the grape tomatoes are all fine. One of the huge problems with food right now is the cost. The absolute exorbitant cost of so many groceries. So grilling is a great opportunity. You can take advantage of lesser cuts. That's what they call it. It seems so rude. But cuts of meat and chicken that aren't that popular or haven't been.
Like what? Name some.
Okay, skirt steak is a fabulous example. Skirt steak's very inexpensive. It's a long, thin piece. It's got some natural fat in it. And if you marinate it in some fresh ginger and a little soy and maybe a rice wine vinegar and throw it on the grill, it will be every bit as exquisite, if not better, than your thick T-bone steak that traditionally was served. Even with chicken, thighs are half the price of breasts. Thighs and dark meat have a lot more flavor and a lot more juice. They don't dry out as much. So these are just little things you can do.
Now, I want to note, Kathy, that your skewers are like
ancient.
Aren't
they dazzling?
They're fantastic. They've got handles with, looks like, dancing men on them.
I know. I don't even remember where I got them. I've had them for years. You certainly don't need fancy metal skewers, although what I like about metal skewers is you don't throw them out each time and
right.
They last.
But if you do use the wooden skewers, what should we know beforehand?
There's very inexpensive bamboo skewers here with little pointy tips. You must soak them in water first. They have to be soaked in water for almost a half an hour. Mm. Otherwise, think about it. You're putting a very thin piece of wood on a hot, hot flame and it will just burn up. Also, you might notice I'm using tongs. These are fairly inexpensive little tongs. Well, the worst thing you can do when you're grilling foods, particularly meat and fish, is to stab it with a fork. What happens is even the vegetables, all the juices come out, and it dries up on the grill. So tongs allow you to turn things over like this without even touching the food, really, and nothing is pierced, and nothing, you're not going to lose any precious juices. Okay, here is a little trick, too. I have a tiny little cup here of olive oil with a little pastry brush. You could use a spoon, and I'm going to just dip it on the food because I want to keep these veggies nice and moist.
And to remind people, we have the skewer of red onions chopped into wedges. We have the panels of peppers, yellow and orange on another skewer, and you've got the marinated chicken on another, and hoo boy,
it's getting smoky. But here's an even better tip, particularly for people who are like watching calories, which so many people do in the summer, and they're thinking, I don't want to brush my food with olive oil. Take a lemon or a lime if you're grilling a piece of fish and squeeze it directly onto the vegetables, and it's like a lubricant. I mean, it just keeps them very juicy and gives them that fresh lemony flavor. So what I did with the feta cheese, and you could do this with tofu, and you could do it with any firm cheese, I lightly brushed cubes about 2 inches long of feta cheese from a block with a tiny bit of olive oil, and then I coated them in panko breadcrumbs, which is a Japanese breadcrumb. It's very coarse. And what that's going to do is protect it. I'm going to put it right on the heat there.
Just laying the blocks of feta cheese
directly
on.
So you think, why isn't it just melting? They're very well chilled. We're going to put our tomatoes on. We're going to do the olives last. And I'm going to put the tomatoes on the side because they don't need a ton of heat. It's really that chicken that needs the most heat. So if we've got our feta going, our tomatoes, our olives, our chicken, and our peppers, we've got our Greek salad. No lettuce. This would be beautiful served on a bed of fresh garden lettuce. You could serve it with pita bread or yogurt. Yogurt with some garlic and olive oil and lemon, and it would be a delicious sauce with this.
With, of course, apologies, too. Everyone who loves Greek salad, but you, Kathy, of course, want to think of a way to...
to make it more interesting.
Make it more exciting. Right. Now, the olives on the skewer just went on. That is so funny.
Here, I'm going to just do a little bit of olive oil right on the olives so we get a double olive flavor. And notice our tomatoes are starting to soften. They'll blister. Ooh, it's getting smoky. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they soften, they're ready to come off. And then we have a whole meal here, and as I mentioned, we can serve the vegetarian, the meat eater, and you just pull it off the skewers and give everybody a hunk of pita bread, and it's a really beautiful Mediterranean grilled summer meal.
Oh, the feta is great. What's that crunch on it again?
That's panko breadcrumb. You could use regular, but it gives you a great texture. What do you think of that smoky olive?
I love it.
Isn't that awesome? And this is not a fancy olive. This is not your $10 olive. This is your go-to-the-grocery store, the kind that kids used to love, the pimento-stuffed green olives.
Well, Kathy, I think this also could be a wonderful way to celebrate the 4th with sort of a nod to someone's ethnic origins.
Absolutely.
Think of a food that's, you know, something that you eat every day and visualize it on the grill.
There you go. We've got a little red from the tomatoes, the white from the feta, and luckily there's nothing blue here. Little black charred peppers, but there's so many different ways to use all kinds of food and have a wonderful holiday weekend.
Kathy Guns, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Here in our resident chef, Kathy Gunst. For more on her chicken Greek salad, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Hitesh Hati, Rebecca Shear, and Jill Ryan. Doug Sugars is our engineer, assisted today by Mike Toda. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns, Hamad Ahmed, Colin Foss, Rachel Konowitz, our managing editor, Chris Ballman, and the senior producer of Here and Now, Kathleen Sullivan. No, Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.